dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A colleague of mine who has a lot of experience in the business of intelligence, having served initially as an analyst in the Central Intelligence Agency for the better part of two decades, and as a chief of staff to Under Secretary of State John Bolton, then as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee, and most recently as the Chief of Staff and Executive Secretary of the Trump National Security Council, is, of course, Fred Flights, our President and CEO at the Center for Security Policy and a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. I wanted to catch up with him, among other things, about the President's travels to Japan and some of the takeaways from the trip. Fred, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, Frank, it's good to be here.
Well, you may have been on the advance program there in Asia when you were out there yourself, but I'm interested in your takeaway from what came of the president's visit with Prime Minister Abe in Japan and with the new emperor of Japan, and specifically what you think was their sort of shared vision of the region during their talks.
Well, Frank, I think it was a successful visit, and there's a lot to talk about concerning the U.S.-Japan relationship, North Korea, Iran, and how the president is trying to improve the trade agreements, not just with China, but also with Japan. I regard a strong relationship with Japan as crucial to defending American interest in the Far East concerning China. Without a strong Japan, without a strong relationship with Japan, we're never going to hold off China. And I think the president recognizes that, and Prime Minister Abe recognizes that. And, you know, one thing that commentators aren't mentioning today is how Japan agreed during this visit to buy over 100 stealth fighters, F-35s, during this visit. This is huge. It's a huge defense sale for U.S. defense contractors. And it is a sign of confidence of Japan in this relationship. North Korea is something that dominated this this trip, and there was some criticism of the president for downplaying recent missile tests by North Korea. Well, I was just in South Korea, and I heard South Korean and American military officials say repeatedly that these missile tests probably represented maybe an act of indignation and anger by Kim Jong-un because he was irritated with the way the summit came out. That seems to be the way President Trump is regarding this. Not that he's disregarding these missile tests, not that he thinks they're insignificant, but he doesn't see them as something that is going to stop the resumption of bilateral talks of a summit. We all know that the odds of getting an agreement with North Korea, the odds might be long, but the president has created an opportunity. And he's not going to allow maybe this fit of pique from preventing him from pushing forward with a bilateral agreement.
This, of course, is a complicated business of how you, on the one hand, hold the regime accountable for actions that may be, as John Bolton and Prime Minister Abe said, inconsistent with UN Council, Security Council resolutions, but still have a basis for further negotiations aimed at denuclearizing the North Korean nation. But we're all watching closely how this plays out, Fred Flights, as I know are you, and this must be dealt with, it seems to me, both carefully and seriously by our country as well as Japan, given the stakes to both. Let me ask you, Fred, about North Korea's strategic ally, Iran. This is a country that, of course, also apparently featured in the conversations between the prime minister and the president, to the point where the prime minister evidently has taken it upon himself now to try to provide sort of an interface with the Iranian regime. Give us a flavor from your perspective of how that is likely to work in practice.
Well, the president is insisting that he's open to a bilateral meeting with the Iranian president. And a lot of experts are saying that that's not going to happen. But the Iranian economy is under enormous pressure because of the president's strong approach and reimplementation of sanctions against Iran. He discovered that Prime Minister Abe has a relationship with the Iranian government. I think it's a troubled relationship, but Japan does buy oil from Iran, a good deal of it. And I think the president's taking advantage of an opportunity to try to relay a message to the Iranian regime that he's open to talk. I'm rather pessimistic that that's going to happen. I think the Iranians are so furiously anti-American and anti-Israel. I don't see the prospect of that happening to be possible in the near future. But the president is trying to seize on an opportunity, and he's not closing the door to the possibility of talks. Now, the Iranians recently have indicated that they might be interested in talks, assuming that we lift sanctions. The good thing about the sanctions, Frank, is not only that it's hurting the Iranian economy, we now know it's hurting Hezbollah. It's giving Iran less money to fund its terrorist groups, which I think is another big reason why the president's Iran policy is a big success.
Right. Well, and it's certainly much needed, that's for sure. Fred, let me just ask you, you tweeted the other day about reports concerning array, apparently, of policy differences between your old boss, Ambassador John Bolton, and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. Share with us your thoughts on this reporting.
Well, Frank, you and I are honored to be friends of both men. And it's why the center has such unusual influence right now to help promote good foreign policy, because we are able to interact not just with the White House, but with the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor. And like, we know that this is just nonsense, that Ambassador Bolton and Secretary of State Pompeo get along quite well. They discuss foreign policy issues almost every morning at, 7 or 8 a.m. I used to see that when I would meet with Ambassador Bolton every morning when I was his chief of staff at the NSC. There are people in the permanent bureaucracy who want to circulate rumors that there's problems or infighting and squabbling between these two top officials. And frankly, Frank, you and I know who some of these people are. I think this is absolute nonsense. I think they have a good working relationship. They're dealing with some difficult questions. I don't doubt that there are some people at lower levels at state who would like to create this illusion of infighting, but I got to tell you, it's absolute nonsense.
Well, it's heartening to hear, Fred, because while this would be an unusual administration if there were not differences between various agencies and departments of the government, it does seem to me these are two exemplary national security practitioners, and they seem to me, based on my experience of both men, to have a worldview and a sense of the national interest, as does Donald Trump, that is very much more aligned than at odds. And so it's heartening to hear your description of this as fake news. I appreciate you joining us, Fred Flights, as always, and for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy. Thank you for joining us today. Come back to us next week, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Ken Timmerman a bit more about Iran, the prospects for regime change there, the need for it, as well as the latest developments about how Notre Dame burned. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Ken Timmerman. He is a nationally recognized investigative reporter, a champion for freedom around the world, notably in connection with a topic we'll be discussing, Iran, as the president and CEO of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. He is also a highly acclaimed and best-selling author of both works of fiction and nonfiction, including most recently ISIS Begins, a novel of the war in Iraq and the persecution of Christians. We catch up with him in France. It's good to do so. Ken Timmerman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Frank. Thank you.
Ken, I wanted to pick up on something I was discussing with Fred Flights a moment ago, and that is Iran. As I mentioned, you have actually been involved in this for a long time, notably as the head of this Foundation for Democracy in Iran, for which work you've earned a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize, no less. The president said in his press conference with Prime Minister Abe of Japan over the weekend that he was okay with the government of Iran and willing to do some new deal on their nuclear weapons program without concern for regime change. What did you make of that? And more to the point, could we conceivably have a deal worthy of the name with such a regime?
Well, I think the president was being himself when he said that. And remember that he ran for election in 2016 saying he's not a neocon. He is not going to take U.S. forces around the world to bring freedom to other nations. He is going to put America first and defend America's interests first. I would have preferred to hear something else from him, but I appreciate and I acknowledge and I respect what he said. I don't think the Iranians give two hoots, frankly. They don't believe it. They believe that the president and John Bolton, who was, by the way, co-nominated with me for the Nobel Peace Prize, would like to overthrow the regime in Tehran. They feel threatened. And I have to say that the current ramping up of tensions is based on very specific threats from the Iranian regime that the U.S. became aware of because of a high-level defector who came out in the middle of the month of April, the former head of the Revolutionary Guards intelligence forces. It's not based on any U.S. desire to confront Iran or to go to war with Iran, but we've been gradually ramping up our defenses in the region to protect American assets, Americans specifically who were targeted in Iraq, contractors and others, and that was one of the things that Ali Nasiri, this defector, brought out, and specific U.S. positions that were being challenged by the Iranians.
Tell us a little bit more about this defector, because that had to have been a body blow to the regime, making them considerably more nervous both about what we now knew about what they've got going on, as well as how we might to further bring pressure to bear against them, didn't it not?
You bet. And this is the third high-ranking defector that I know of. I was involved in two of those earlier defections. One was the son of the Revolutionary Guards commander, Mohsen Rezai, and the second was a deputy defense minister who came out in 2007. Nasiri was the head of Rev Guards intelligence. He knew where all the bodies were buried, literally. He knows, for example, where Bob Levinson, the FBI agent who was kidnapped by the Iranians over 10 years ago, is being held. He knows about their nuclear weapons programs, not just the programs, but the secret enrichment sites and development weaponization sites that everybody's been looking for the past 20 years. He knows about all of the weapons and the plans that they have for their proxies around the world, whether it's the Houthis in Yemen, whether it's Hezbollah or Hamas. He knows about those attacks that took place with the armed drones against the Saudi pipeline and against the ships in the United Arab Emirates. So because of that knowledge, we know, and the Iranians know that we know, that they were behind all of those attacks, and they can't really hide it, and they are sweating in their burkas.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we can turn up the heat further. But do you agree, Ken Timmerman, based upon your long study of this subject, that really the only hope for an end to the threats that we face and the region and Israel and others from the Islamic Republic of Iran is for it to cease being the Islamic Republic of Iran under these clerics who seek, as they have said endlessly, to bring death to America.
That's right, and to wipe Israel off the face of Iran. By the way, I call it the Islamic State of Iran. There's nothing Republican about the way they elect their government. It is an Islamic state, and it prefigures what happened with ISIS. Very clearly, you can see that. Yes, there is. This regime is like a dagger pointed at the heart of the Middle East. Every terror activity that you can see, including those of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, have their origins in Iran. You know, I work with the families of 9/11 victims. We won a $10 billion judgment against Iran for their involvement in the 9/11 attacks. We proved it in a court of law in the Southern District of New York, that they have been involved with Sunni terror groups, with the Taliban, with Hamas, with Al-Qaeda, as well as all of these Shia groups in Iraq and Lebanon and elsewhere. So, yes, they are the source of international terrorism focused on us, our interests, and our allies in the world and in the region.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that that case, Ken, because it was such a prime example of the falsity of the contention that Shia and Sunni won't collaborate when they have a common enemy, namely us. They do, they have, and they will continue to, unfortunately, in the future. Hence the need for regime change in Iran, in my judgment. Let me ask you, Ken, about a different topic. You are in France at the moment. You, therefore, were obviously very much aware of what has happened over the weekend, voting on members for the European Parliament. Some considerable upset in much of Europe, but especially in France. Tell us what happened and why.
Well, what happened is really quite simple. When people went to the polls this Sunday, and I was at the polling places in my own little village, and I talked to friends and neighbors who were down there voting, they were voting for France, not for Europe. And guess what? The message that President Trump has given to Americans that has resonated so deeply, put America first, is resonating here as well. Put France first. Why should the French are saying to themselves, why should we vote for people who put Europe first instead of France first? And that's why you had this center-right coalition. It's actually it's a very curious coalition. It's not really center-right. It's far left and center-right who are fed up with the mondialists, as they call it, the mondialistes, right? These global one-worlders like Macron, like President Macron, and they want to put France first, and that's who they voted for in the elections. And they won a plurality. They were the first party, and now Marine Le Pen and Front National are the first party, political party in France.
Yeah. And does that have implications on domestic politics as well as what goes on in Brussels? Ken Timmerman?
Yeah, absolutely. Remember, you have this long-standing conflict with the so-called yellow jackets. And these are people who put the yellow vest that you carry in your car for emergency situations. They put it up on the dashboard so you can see them all the time when you're driving. It's really hilarious. And people are fed up. They're fed up with a government in Paris that does not respect the people of France, what happens in rural areas, who put Brussels first, the European Union first, and don't put the interest of French people first. This is a big movement, and it's not limited to France. You see it in Germany, in Sweden, in Denmark, in Holland, in many different countries.
Do you anticipate that it will mark a significant change in the sort of global agenda of Brussels and its determination to essentially eviscerate the sovereign nations of Europe?
In the long term, yes. I think globalism is on its way down, but it's going to be a long way down because they are deeply, deeply entrenched in Brussels. But the people are speaking, and they're speaking up, they're speaking louder and louder, and I think it's a matter of time. It will be a number of years. It's not going to happen overnight, but people are really fed up with Brussels. I think the European Union, as we have known it recently, is over.
Wow. From your lips to God's ears, as they say, Ken Timmerman. Let me ask you quickly, in closing, Ken, almost 2 months ago now, a terrible thing happened in Paris, as you know, the burning of Notre Dame. And even as the fires were raging, we were assured that there was no indication that this was arson, no consideration given to the possibility that there was terror involved. Months have, as I say, now passed, and as far as I can tell, we haven't heard what the results of the investigation into the fire, the source of the fire, how it spread so quickly across the roof of this magnificent cathedral. What are you hearing on the ground there about what precipitated this and who was responsible, if that's known?
Yeah, it's quite quite remarkable, Frank. Anybody who has lived with old buildings knows that these giant oaken beams do not take fire very quickly. It's very hard to get to put them on fire. And the cathedral went up in an instant, went up, you know, the whole thing was ablaze within 20 minutes. Very, very unusual. There is a photo, a video circulating on YouTube at the time of a Moroccan worker fleeing the scene up on the scaffolding. Since then, very recently, in fact, the French media has been talking about an investigation of some of the Moroccan workers who were on the scene, and also the individual who in 2011 did the modernization of the electrical system in Notre Dame said there was absolutely no way that this was an electrical fire because everything had been brought up to code. There was no, really, very little possibility there could have been a short circuit. So it's looking increasingly like arson, and the arson obviously would have been a terrorist-related act.
Yeah. Ken, stay on it. You do the best investigative reporting that I know of. Keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again very soon with updates. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
It's my pleasure to say we are joined by Kevin Freeman, one of our duty experts on matters involving particularly his area of expertise, economic warfare, the subject of his television program at The Blaze TV, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, also of his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, his blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and his efforts to educate all of us on programs like ours about what is afoot in the nature of economic warfare against this country and how we must respond. A prime mover behind a lot of it, of course, is communist China and its unrestricted warfare program. Kevin, it's so good to have you with us to talk a bit about it, give us an update, and tell us how we're doing in responding to it all.
Great. Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
So there are some interesting news reports out that I just wanted quickly to get you to comment on. It seems that the Chinese are stealing not just our intellectual property, but others around the world as well, notably a Swiss computer chip manufacturer. This doesn't come as a surprise exactly, but shouldn't it constitute a basis for an awful lot of other countries to be as concerned as we now are under the Trump administration about this practice?
Well, I'm sure that they are. Other countries have witnessed Chinese theft of intellectual property for years. They know it's going on. The problem is that the Chinese economy has successfully embedded itself around the world. The Belt and Road Initiative, they've bought officials either by giving lucrative deals to their children, as we saw with Hunter Biden, or other things. And so it really is hard to extricate yourself. But the facts are the facts. And China, in this particular example, was stealing Swiss technology. They've stolen German technology. They've stolen technology from nearly every developed country around the world.
And yet we don't see them supporting President Trump much in terms of this trade deal, at least publicly. I gather that there's a fair amount of support for him privately, but it sure would be nice to have them evidencing it in a more obvious way. Talk about the possibility that the Chinese are preparing to dump the dollar and what that might mean as a practical matter for our economy, for the value of the dollar itself, and our interests more generally, Kevin Freeman.
Well, Robert Samuelson wrote a column in the Washington Post, "Are We at Risk of a Chinese Dollar Dump?" And Samuelson is a big name in the economic field. I mean, he wrote one of the textbooks that I studied when I was in college. He basically says that we're not at risk because, you know, the dollar is strong. People want our treasuries and so forth. The Chinese are clearly aware of everything Samuelson said here, and there's a ring of truth to it. What he's missing is that ceteris paribus, you know, that assumes for an economist that all things remain static, that all other things being equal. Chinese are well aware of the treasury bond strength, the move to safe assets and so forth, and they have been putting great efforts to undermine the reality of what he sees as an impenetrable defense. So it's kind of a Maginot line. I don't know if it's crossed this year, or next year, 5 years from now. But the Chinese and the Russians have been undermining the very things that Samuelson says protects the dollar, why China would not dump, because it would hurt them too much and so forth. So they're aware of this, and they've been working against his premise for now since 2013, when they said they would de-dollarize the world, and they will continue to work against his premise. We should not take solace and sit back and say, don't worry, the dollar will always be fine, because it will not if we don't shore up the efforts China's against the efforts China's making against us and really strengthen the dollar.
Yeah. Well, and particularly, as you've discussed here and elsewhere, Kevin Freeman, the need to counter the attacks on sort of the institutions that are underpinning the dominance of the dollar that the Chinese seem busily to be trying to replicate or subvert. This is unrestricted warfare, and we fail to recognize it as such at our great peril.
Yeah, but Samuelson does see it as a marketplace, but China sees it as a battle space.
Another interesting story, Kevin, was a report that the Chinese military has decided to purge U.S. operating systems from some of its machinery. This is at the same moment that we're being blithely assured by the People's Liberation Army doing business as Huawei that, no worries, mate, we can be entrusted with having their software, or hardware for that matter, deeply embedded in our various systems, military and otherwise. Your reaction to that seeming disconnect?
Yeah, that is a kind of an interesting view. As they say, we're worried because if we use Windows operating system, you all might hack into it because it would be very vulnerable to Americans. And yet they want us to adopt and accept Chinese operating systems. So my reactions are twofold. Number one is it shows how disingenuous the Chinese argument is. That this is a global battle space. It's not a marketplace. Windows and serves companies and countries around the world. It is not created at the behest of the U.S. government, whereas any Chinese operating system will be. Now, I think in the long run, this will be detrimental for China, because I think a free and fair market creation like the Windows operating system will be far superior to anything that they're able to cook up. While they may find it impenetrable, it will be less efficient. So it will be interesting to watch this play out. I don't think that they will be able to create a replacement, but they will certainly try, and it will be much more difficult to be hacked. So they're proving that they're disingenuous, number one, and number two, they're embarking on a path that will be interesting to watch.
Interesting and possibly ominous. We'll see. Kevin Freeman, one of the other stories, speaking of Huawei, that caught my eye, well, it's actually two stories, but both relate to the use by that company, this Chinese telecommunications conglomerate, of our own court system against us. There's, of course, the recent ruling by a federal judge in California last week to the effect that Huawei can basically take down Qualcomm, one of its most important competitors and an essential part of a 5G system that we would build in competition with the Chinese, on the one hand. And on the other, they've now announced that they're going to sue the U.S. government for enacting a law that prohibits their products from being included in our networks for the reasons you've just described, Kevin. What's up with this? Do we have any protection against such a hostile, what the president has called a foreign adversary, using our courts against us?
The Chinese claim is they have a right to use our courts because they're just operating just like any other company anywhere else. And the problem is that we have evidence to the contrary. The Chinese government is deeply embedded in Huawei, and despite any claims or assurances to the contrary, the reality of it is a U.S. company operating in China has to operate according to the Chinese government's purpose, and therefore it is only obvious that a Chinese company, and in fact there's a law in China that requires the companies operate on behalf of the Chinese Communist government. So it is ridiculous that our courts would take up cases like this, and it's ridiculous that they would attempt to sue the Congress for passing a law to protect the American people. In the end, I don't think either effort will will succeed for long. But the problem is that in the court action against Qualcomm, Huawei was joined by other companies, other American companies, for example, that believed that this needs to be fair. They were looking out for their own economic self-interest rather than looking out for the good of the nation. And I think the court siding with them is against the good of the nation. And again, what we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. They're fighting a war, and we're looking for market share.
Indeed, and indifferent to where the supply chains run from. Which brings me to another topic, Kevin. You have been very active for years in trying to raise awareness among American investors and people like yourself who advise them about the dangers of this disconnect between the battle space and the marketplace, specifically by trying to train and encourage certified financial accountants and other advisors to essentially invest patriotically. Interestingly, this seems to be a refrain that the Department of Defense has lately picked up. Tell us a little bit about this, especially against the backdrop of reports that Alibaba is planning on coming back to the U.S. capital markets for another $20 billion in underwriting.
Yeah, actually, Alibaba is planning to go through Hong Kong, which rejected them earlier, but they no doubt are trying to attract American investments in a secondary offering through the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, $20 billion after they acquired $25 billion. Why? Because they continue to use our money to buy up our technology and to buy Chinese influence around the world. And it is a frightening thing. But the Pentagon has noticed that China has developed internally investments with sovereign wealth funds and in other nations, and the Chinese having their foreign currency reserves. So they're able to affect benefits for their defense systems and military and so forth. And what the Pentagon has noticed is that Silicon Valley doesn't work necessarily with American interests. They view themselves as globalists. And as a result, technology that's developed can be bought up in cases by China and other adversarial countries. Now, we have CFIUS that helps protect Chinese foreign investment in the United States and helps to stop those areas. And Qualcomm, a company we mentioned earlier, and foreign acquisition was stopped because of CFIUS. But Pentagon has realized we don't have anything on the offensive side. Where do we gather patriotic investors that want a decent return on their money and they want to further American interests around the world? So Ellen Lord, the Pentagon's top acquisition official, has unveiled the launch of the Trusted Capital Marketplace Program. They call it TCM. This was noted in an article earlier this month from Defense News. And I'm very excited about this because that's something I told them we need to do 10 years ago and 8 years ago and 6 years ago.
Kevin Freeman, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time as well as the great work you're doing at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Next up, we'll speak with Sam Faddis after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Sam Faddis, better known as Charles Faddis, but whatever nom he uses, he is a former CIA operations officer in the clandestine service who served some 20 years in the Middle East, South Asia, and Europe. He has been a candidate for Congress. He is, among other things, an author, notably of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. He's also an active contributor to And Magazine online, and he is a senior partner with Artemis LLC and a go-to guy for us on intelligence matters. Sam, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you.
You wrote a piece recently, Sam, at And about the phenomenon of going to ground when a clandestine operation is blown. This is what professionals do. And you suggest that that's almost certainly what's happening at the moment in the U.S. government's deep state, where some of those who were almost certainly implicated in the anti-Trump conspiracy or coup, as you call it, have not yet been identified or certainly subjected to the kind of scrutiny that some of the others have. We'll talk about some of those others in a moment, but I just wanted to tease that out with you. Sam, do you have some specific candidates in mind for people who probably were up to their eyeballs in this effort to keep Donald Trump from, in the first instance, winning the presidency, and then once he had won it, from being able to perform functions of president?
Right. Well, as you pointed out, Frank, I mean, first of all, intelligence professionals don't wait until there's a disaster and then say, hey, what the heck should we do now? This is planning from the outset. And a plot on the scale of a coup to take down a sitting president of the United States is not carried out with a handful of individuals. So the idea that, you know, you've identified six or eight folks or whatever the number is and we're done is kind of silly. I think there are a lot of questions. We could start with the current head of the Central Intelligence Agency, Gina Haspel. She's a protege of Brennan's.
That would be John Brennan, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency under Obama.
Exactly. Who of course, appears to be, if there is a central ringleader in this entire thing, that would be him. She's a protege. In any event, she was literally at his right hand through all of these critical junctures. Very, very difficult to believe that you could be in that position and somehow at the top of operations, top of clandestine operations in the organization, and yet you are somehow mysteriously unaware of this entire plot and uninvolved.
Yeah, Sam, am I right that in addition to having achieved that role at one point in her career, before that, she was the chief of station in the United Kingdom in the period in which British intelligence seems to have been very directly involved in trying to mount intelligence collection against the Trump campaign?
Right. So I am unaware of the exact status of that information. So let me parse my response very carefully. I have certainly read in the press that that is the case, that she was, according to those press reports, that she was chief of station. And given all of the reporting about British involvement early on in this entire thing and information coming from them, whoever was in that position, again, inconceivable that they are somehow out of the loop and not part of this entire thing. So at a minimum, there's a whole lot of questions that have to be answered there, because either you were up to your eyeballs in the coup, or you were somehow so ignorant that you didn't understand what was being done on your watch, that you were used as a pawn. Again, hard to believe.
Hard to believe. And again, this woman is currently the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, which is a problem, I think it's fair to say. Let me ask you, speaking of problems, her mentor, John Brennan, and his close friend and colleague, Jim Clapper, then the director of National Intelligence, were clearly very much engaged in this apparent conspiracy. They are now holding forth from their various vantage points in the American media, demanding, or in the case of John Brennan, I think he used the verb, imploring Gina Haspel and the current director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, to disobey effectively or stand up to Donald Trump, who's ordered the declassification of whatever information the Attorney General believes is relevant to this investigation into the investigators. What are your thoughts on what Brennan and Clapper are up to now, Sam Faddis?
Well, I think they're terrified and they're attempting to use the deep state to save them. Let's stop for a minute and understand what we're talking about here. I mean, you and I use this terminology, but let's just focus on it. This, to all appearances, was an attempted coup, an effort to delegitimize and then remove from office a sitting president elected in a free and fair election for the first time in our history. This is a threat. I don't care where you are on the political spectrum. This is a threat to the fabric of the republic. You go down this road and, we end up like the Romans. We don't have a republic anymore. And that's the magnitude of what we're talking about. And these guys are terrified of where things are going to go if it starts coming out and has exposed what they were really doing and the extent to which they engineered this entire thing from the outset.
Yeah. Well, again, these are loaded terms, conspiracy and coup, and the jury is still out, quite literally. It hasn't even really been impaneled as far as we know, but an investigation is underway that I pray to God is going to follow the evidence where it leads. And I think with Bill Barr as the Attorney General and John Durham as the U.S. Attorney charged with getting to the bottom of this, we will find out what role John Brennan, Jim Clapper, Jim Comey, and so many others were actually playing in trying to obstruct the will of the American people. Let me turn to one other thing. Speaking of John Brennan, it's been reported, Sam, that after President Trump, I thought quite properly, decided to revoke the clearances he held that gave him, on a continuing basis, even after he left government, access to very sensitive information, which it seemed he was capitalizing on to mount the kind of post-government campaign that he's been engaged in with NBC and its subsidiaries especially. Yet the president's team apparently didn't actually go through the steps needed to have those clearances revoked. Can you shed any light on what's going on there and whether that's advisable under the circumstances?
Well, my assumption is that what that means is that the bureaucracy blocked the president's attempt to take this action. And I think what it does is it highlights the extent of the resistance all across Washington, D.C. The bureaucracy, certainly elements of the bureaucracy, fully intend to continue to disobey and resist this president and effectively wait him out. And they are going to continue to try to block his moves at every turn. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives them that authority. There's no way on earth they should feel empowered to do that, but that's where we are at this point in history.
Well, this again will bear considerable watching, as it seems as though there may be, you know, compromises taking place even as we speak, long after John Brennan held government office. And there's some talk, I'm given to understand, that he's aspiring to come back as the Secretary of Defense. So it seems to me all the more reason to be doing what the president has suggested is needed here now. But could you conceive of such a thing, knowing what we do about John Brennan? It's hard to imagine that he could be confirmed.
You know, it's hard to imagine what is possible anymore, isn't it? I mean, it's certainly true in my mind that there are very, very powerful interests in this country that want a day to come where they can just consign everything associated with Trump, you know, to sort of the trash bin and basically say, okay, let's just get back to doing business the way we always were.
Back to the revolution, as our friend Diana West has called it, back to the revolution that Donald Trump, the counter-revolutionary, has been impeding. And it was for that reason, she believes, that such a coup or conspiracy was mounted to prevent him from securing office. Sam Pattis, thank you as always for your insights into what is going on and what its implications may be, especially in the shadowy world of intelligence, which you have operated in for so many years with such great effect for our country. Keep up the great work, my friend, at Artemis. Come back to us again soon. In the meantime, I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.